Alone? Willa missed her all the same. There was a kind of camaraderie in the danger they had shared, the way they had worked together, the way they had helped each other. Willa knew that the Yater Kiernan would have killed her with that spear if the panther hadn't struck him down. The cat had moved so fast, faster than anything she'd ever seen. And it was for her. Not only had she saved a black panther, the black panther had saved her in return. She spent the next several hours combing the forest, looking for the panther's tracks and trying to pick up her scent. Willa foraged along the way, eating the wild strawberries she found hiding beneath their white blossoms and the green sochan leaves growing along the little streams in the forest. Eventually, she returned to the bank of the river where she had begun. It was no use. The ghost of the forest had truly disappeared. Willa plopped down on the ground in disappointment. She knew that the truth was, she wasn't just looking for the panther. The panther wasn't what she longed for. She longed for her mammal, and for her sister, for anyone. She wanted someone to talk to about what she'd seen, about what she'd done, about all the things that had happened. She hadn't spoken with a living person in days. Her mamma had been the last. Where was she going to find a new den, a new place to hang her cocoon and sleep her nights? Her grandmother had given her the knowledge and skills to survive in the forest, but where was she going to find a place for her heart to live? How was she going to live in the world so alone? She looked around at the forest, and then out across the water of the river, not sure where to go or what to do. Seeing the destruction of the forest had left her feeling so helpless, so small. The Cherokee families she'd seen earlier that day were long gone now. The wolves, the bears, they had their own kind, their own lives to live. She was truly alone. She stared into the river, letting the mesmerizing flow of the water wash over her mind. She wanted the motion of it to numb her, to sweep away the ache, to somehow blend her woeful spirit into the world. But even as she watched the flow of the river, she knew where it would lead her. In all that had happened over the last few days, in all the violence and conflict she had seen, one act of kindness stuck in her mind. She kept thinking about it, the unexpectedness of it. She couldn't get free of it. She didn't want it to be the answer. She didn't want to take that path. It made no sense to her. But the whole time she was sitting there staring into the water, a part of her already knew what she was going to do. All the streams in her heart were leading her back to that one place, that one moment. And it wasn't far. All she had to do was follow the river. Chapter 37. Willa crept up to the edge of the forest, wove herself into the leaves of the undergrowth, and gazed toward the wooden lair of the dayfolk man who had shot her. The man was walking across the grass, his black and white dog following closely at his side. He wore a brown vest and a shirt with wrinkled sleeves rolled up to his elbows, and a wide-brimmed hat that shaded his eyes from the sun. She didn't know all of the English words the homesteaders used, but she was pretty sure that they called the lairs they lived in a cabin or a house, depending on how they had cut up the bodies they had used to make it. They were crude words, and she didn't like them in her mind. And she knew that the barn was where they kept their animals. Many of the homesteaders lived in small log cabins, but this man had built a house, a barn, and a third building she didn't have a name for. And this was the building he was walking toward. He had covered the roof of the building with overlapping slices of dead trees, and he'd pieced together the walls from stones he'd stolen from the river. But the oddest feature of the building was that it had a large wooden wheel on the side, with a thick central shaft, 8 spokes, and what looked like rectangular wooden buckets hanging on the curve of the wheel. She couldn't imagine what it was all for. The man walked over to a narrow channel that he'd dug in the ground to take water from the river, and then pulled on a lever that opened some sort of divider. The stolen water came gushing through a chute and splashed down onto the buckets. There was a deep groaning sound, and then, to her amazement, the wheel began to turn, the buckets filling at the top and then emptying at the bottom, with the water pouring into a small pond, and then continuing on through another channel back toward the river. She'd never seen anything like it. The man was stealing the water of the river and then giving it back. The shaft in the center of the wheel turned and turned, and something inside the building rumbled with the grinding, gritty sound of stone rubbing on stone. She couldn't understand how he took the movement of the water and changed it into the movement of the wheel, but that was the spell he had cast. But then a loud clanking noise erupted from the building, and the wheel shook violently, the wood twisting and creaking as if the wheel was going to tear apart. The man lurched forward and closed the divider as quickly as he could, bringing the wheel to a shuddering halt. He gazed at his contraption in stunned confusion. Then his face clouded with anger, and he clenched his jaw, as if he suspected an enemy had purposefully sabotaged his machine. He grabbed a tool with a long metal handle, then climbed up the giant wheel and crawled through the spokes into a dense thicket of metal branches. He cranked and he twisted. He hammered and he shoved, shouting out harsh words she didn't understand. When he finally crawled out again, his knuckles were bloody. He went over to the lever and pulled it for the second time. The water came tumbling down as it had before, and the wheel started to turn once more. This time, he didn't just look satisfied that his machine was working. He looked defiant, as if he had defeated the most powerful of enemies. Over the next hour, he carried large burlap bags into the building on his shoulder. She had seen the farmers in Cade's Cove filling bags like these with wheat from their fields. She stayed where she was in the forest, but she watched him through the open windows and door of the building. The man poured the bags into a metal mouth where the grains trickled down between 2 flat stones and were ground into a whitish-yellow powder. While the water wheel did its work, the man walked over to the stack of severed limbs and trunks at the side of his house, picked up a killing axe, and started cleaving the logs in half. The wood was from the previous season, so she didn't hear its cries, but it was still difficult to watch. She hated how he used a wood-handled axe to cut more wood. As he split one log after another, he grunted, slamming the axe into the wood harder and harder with each stroke, the wood making a sharp cracking sound as he split it. Sweat beaded on his brow, and he ground his teeth as he hurled the cloven slabs of wood aside. It seemed as if he had fixed the problem with the wheel, so why was he so angry? Frustration seemed to be boiling up inside him. It was like he didn't want to just split those pieces of tree, but crack open the earth they'd grown from. His breathing got louder and louder. His whiskered face contorted with pain. And he just kept splitting, one log after another, until his hands bled onto the handle of the axe. It reminded her of when she climbed the mountain, the way she hadn't cared that the rocks were cutting into her hands. She had wanted the rocks to cut into her hands. Finally exhausted, he hurled the axe to the ground, collapsed beside the pile of wood that he had made, and dropped his head into his cupped hands. He rubbed his face and eyes, as if he wanted to smear some memory from his mind. In that moment, she remembered sitting by the stream that had carried her away from the lair, trying to rub the images of her mamma's dead body away. She remembered the longing in her heart and the sadness in her soul. The man's shoulders drooped as he went quiet, and she watched as his anger melted into a slow and dying anguish. He made no noise, but she could see his body shaking as he sobbed. His dog, seeming to sense his master needed his help, lay down beside him. The man slowly stopped sobbing and rubbed the scruff of the dog's neck with his hand as he stared with glazed eyes out into the forest. She didn't understand what was happening to him, why he was acting this way. But she could see that the man did not have his killing stick with him, and his axe was out of reach now, a few feet away. Her heart pounded, and perspiration rose on her arms. She was finding it more and more difficult to breathe. But she slowly stepped out of the forest, and she showed herself to him. Chapter 38. The man looked at her in surprise, but did not immediately try to kill her. He did not run for his killing stick when he saw her standing there at the edge of the woods. He did not reach for the axe or pull out the knife he carried at his side. He did not rouse his dog. He did not move in any way. But she knew he saw her. She could see his striking, bright blue eyes staring at her intently, as if he could not quite believe what he was seeing. She stood a dozen steps away from him, but she felt the movement of his chest as he breathed slow, steady breaths. "You're alive," he said, his voice soft and low, but filled with a trace of amazement. "And you've come back to me." She did not speak, but she studied him, and she let him study her. And for the moment, for the both of them, that was enough. Her heart beat in her chest as he looked at her. The quills on the back of her neck tingled. "This is my enemy," she thought. "And he's seeing me." The man stood perfectly still, as if he knew that the slightest movement would scare her off. When a breeze swept through the boughs of the trees, she stepped back, blended into the forest, and disappeared. Chapter 39. The next day, she watched him from the forest. He moved in and out of the house, sometimes working in his barn, feeding his goats and his chickens, or using tools she did not understand. Other times he worked in the building that used the water of the river to turn the giant wheel. He worked quietly and on his own, but sometimes he paused in his work and looked out into the forest, scanning the trees with a careful eye. As the sun set and slowly withdrew its light from the trees of the surrounding forest, the man went back into the house. She watched as the window near the eating room lit up with the soft glow of a candle. The stars above the trees provided all the light she needed to see, but she liked watching the glowing radiance of the candle as the man moved from one room to another, the light moving with him, leaving darkness behind, until finally he went up the stairs into the room where she had once seen him lying asleep in his bed, and the candle went out. It was a warm summer evening, with yellow-green fireflies lighting on and off in the open area in front of the man's house while he slept. She walked over to a stand of beautiful old sourwood trees growing near the side of the house, with their craggy gray bark and their long, wavy limbs. "Hello, my friends," she said to them in the old language, touching their trunks with her open hand as she walked among them. "It's good to meet you all." Deciding not to make a cocoon that night, she picked the tallest of the trees and began to climb its trunk. "I hope you don't mind a friend for the night," she said as she reached its upper branches. Sourwoods weren't large trees, and they had bitter-tasting leaves, but she loved their nectar when their flowers blossomed, and she appreciated their peaceful spirits. She always missed them when they slept in the winter, and rejoiced when they came awake each spring. She found a good spot in the branches near a tight ball of leaves with a bundle of baby squirrels snoring inside. As the tendrils of the tree gently encircled her body to make sure she didn't fall, she curled up and went to sleep. It was the first night in a long time that she didn't dream of stealing. Chapter 40. The next morning when she woke, the dog was sitting at the base of the tree, his ears perked and his eyes looking up into the branches. Had the dog somehow detected her? Or had the nest of squirrels caught his attention? He wasn't barking or growling, and he didn't seem anxious to attack. But he looked keenly interested, like he was certain there was something up in the tree. Maybe the two-legged forest creature he'd seen the day before. "Come on, Scout," the man called as he walked out of the house, down the steps, and toward the barn. But upon noticing the dog's position by the tree, he stopped. The man turned.
"Scout?"
But the dog didn't move. His nose pointed straight up into the tree.
"This was a truly bad place to spend the night," Willa decided. "Now I've been treed by the pesky dog."
As the man walked toward the base of the tree, Willa's heart thumped. Goosebumps rose on her arms. The man stood below her and peered up into the limbs of the tree. His eyes moved from one spot to the next, looking for her, but her legs and arms had taken on the appearance of the branches, and her face was nothing but leaves.
"What do you see, boy?"
he asked as he crouched down beside his dog.
"Is she up there?"
She'd shown herself to them 2 days before, but she wouldn't allow them to see her now, not like this, trapped up in a tree peering down at them like an opossum. When the man and his dog finally gave up and left the area of the tree, Willa climbed down. She watched the man go about his daily work. When he walked through his orchard, she became as dark and crooked as an apple tree's trunk. When he tended to his vegetable garden, she became as green and yellow as stalks of corn. And at the end of the day, while the dog napped in the shade and the man went down to the river to wash his hands and face, she crouched on a rock nearby, as blue as water and gray as stone. The man finished washing up, then climbed back up onto the bank and headed toward the path. Willa jumped from the rock she'd been perched on and followed him into the forest. It was there, on the path that led to the house, that she chose to reveal herself once more. She pulled in a long, uncertain breath, relaxed the blend of her skin, and stepped onto the path in front of him. She appeared before him in her natural green colors, her face spotted and streaked, her arms marked with marbled patterns, her dark hair falling around her shoulders, and her eyes emerald green. When he looked up and saw her there, he stopped, surprised, his eyes wide for a moment. But he stood very still.
"I was hoping you'd come around again," he said.
Suddenly, Willa became aware of her own breathing, the position of her feet, and the perspiration on her neck. She studied the man, looking for any signs of threat or attack, taking in all the details. His watching eyes, the light brown whiskers on his face, his hands freshly clean but scratched and worn from his work, his wrinkled tan trousers wet to the knees from standing in the river, all so different from any sort of living thing she'd ever talked to before.
"I'm sorry about what happened," he said. "It was so dark, and you were moving so fast. I couldn't see anything. I shouldn't have pulled that trigger."
He paused, waiting for her to reply. She wanted to speak to him. She wanted to take a few steps closer to him. But she didn't know what to say to him or what to do. On the outside, she imagined she appeared to be standing very still, but on the inside, she felt like a trembling fawn, ready to dash away at any moment.
"But you don't seem to be too badly hurt anymore," he said, almost to himself, as if he was mystified that her wounds had healed so quickly.
"Listen," he added gently. "I know you and I didn't get off to a good start, but I want you to know that I will not harm you. You are welcome here."
She had never heard the Farron of Dead Hollow use the English word welcome, but she had always loved the word Iluin, which she remembered her mother and father saying to her many years before. "Esperdun Iluin Una," they had told her. "The trees will always welcome you." It was one of the few memories she had of her parents. And then the man said something else that surprised her.
"My name is Nathaniel."
Her ears took the unusual sound into her mind, but still she did not reply.
"Do you understand the words I'm speaking?" he asked her softly.
Willa looked at him and took in a long, slow breath.
"I do," she said. They were the first words she had spoken to him.
As soon as the man, Nathaniel, heard her voice, his face lit up with a sudden and genuine smile. She hadn't seen a smile in so long that it brought an unexpected wash of happiness through her, and she couldn't help but smile in return.
"I'm glad," he said. "I was beginning to wonder if you were some kind of spirit or something. Or maybe my wits were finally leaving me for good."
"I'm as real as the trees around you," she said. "I'm just not used to talking to..."
She let words dwindle and didn't finish her sentence.
"I understand," he said. "Sometimes no words is just the right amount."
She wasn't sure exactly what he meant, but she liked the kindness in his voice when he said it.
"Are you hungry?"
he said as he began to walk toward the house and gestured for her to follow him.
"Let's get something to eat."
But the instant he moved, she startled, and she was gone. Chapter 41. She had reacted quickly and disappeared, a reflex more than a decision. But once she had a moment to think about it, she realized the man hadn't been trying to hurt her. He had just started to walk up toward the house. But after it happened, she felt too uncertain to rejoin him, and she withdrew back into the forest on her own. The next morning, when the man Nathaniel and the dog, Scout, came out of the house, the man walked over to the base of the tree in which she was sleeping and set something on the ground.
"In case you change your mind," he said,
and continued on into the forest. When the dog lingered behind to sniff at the plate, the man said,
"No, you've already had your breakfast. Now come on."
Carrying his killing stick in his right hand, the man followed the path that ran along the bank of the river, his dog trotting behind him. Soon they were gone. As Willa climbed down the trunk of the tree and smelled the plate of food, she realized how hungry she truly was. It seemed like she was always hungry. Did the man know this about her? Was that why he had asked her this odd question about whether she was hungry? The Farron of the Dead Hollow Lair would never ask her this question. They did not care. As she crouched on the ground and ate the food, she wondered where the man had gone with his dog and his killing stick. He had seemed very determined to find whatever he was looking for. But that evening, he returned exhausted and empty-handed, the dog walking along dejectedly just behind him. As they came toward the house, she decided to stand in the open where they could see her. But she stayed near the edge of the trees just in case. Her temples immediately started pounding, and she had to work hard to keep her breathing strong and steady. But despite the anxiousness welling up inside her chest, she kept her feet planted firmly in the grass. The moment the dog saw her, he jolted to attention.
"Scout, stay!"
the man said, stopping the dog in its tracks.
"Down!"
The dog went down on his haunches immediately, his whole body shaking with excitement. The dog obviously wanted to run at her, bite her, shake her, tear her to pieces, but the human's command held him in place.
"She's a friend, Scout," the man said firmly. "You're gonna let her be. You got it? Let her be. She's a friend. You just stay."
The dog's eyes blazed with intense curiosity as he watched her, but he seemed to understand the man's instructions. When she felt at least somewhat certain the dog wasn't going to attack her, Willa moved her eyes to the man, Nathaniel. He was already looking at her, and he did not look displeased to see her.
"How was your breakfast this morning?" he asked.
"Thank you," she said, because she thought that was what day folk said to one another.
"Yesterday, I introduced myself. My name is Nathaniel, and this here is Scout. But we didn't get your name."
When she thought about telling him her name, her mind flooded with questions. What did a Farron name mean to him? What did it sound like? In what way could he use it? Could he harm her with it? There were many thoughts going through her mind all at once, and many of them frightened her. But unlike the day before, when her reflexes had acted before she could even think, now her thoughts came more slowly, more in her control.
"What do you wish me to call you?" he asked her.
"My name is Willa," she said finally. Nathaniel nodded.
"That's a fine and lovely name," he said. "It's good to meet you, Willa. Did your mother give you that name?"
"I do not know."
"Is your mother nearby?" the man asked, looking out into the forest. "Or your father?"
"My mother and father are dead."
"I'm sorry to hear that," he said,
his voice filled with something she had never heard outside her own den, a tone, an emotion she didn't have a word for.
"When did your parents pass away?" he asked.
6 years ago," she said.
"Then who takes care of you out here?" he asked.
"Out where?"
"In the forest."
"The forest?"
"I don't understand. Who feeds you and gives you shelter? Where do you live?"
"The forest," she said again.
"There must be someone."
"I left my clan."
"Your clan?"
The man looked around at the forest as if arrows were going to come flying out at him.
"But you're not Cherokee, are you?"
"No," she said. "I'm not Cherokee."
"And you live around here in the forest? That's where you come from?"
Not sure she understood his question, she slowly pointed toward the top of the great mountain, which was visible from the open area in front of his house.
"You come from Klingman's Dome?"
he asked in surprise, but it was clear that he didn't think he was understanding her.
"Don't you live in a town?"
Maybe down in the valley, in Cade's Cove? Or maybe a new homestead I don't know about?
No, I live up there, she said again. But then she realized that wasn't actually true anymore. She didn't live in Dead Hollow any longer. She lived in the forest.
I live here, she said,
knowing that she was probably confusing him as much as he was confusing her.
But who were your parents? What is your last name?
She didn't understand. She had already told him her name. She thought she knew the English words of the day folk, but she realized now that she must not.
Well, in any case...
He turned very slowly this time and carefully gestured for her to follow him.
Come on into the house and get something to eat.
It had startled her before, but this time she held back her reflex to blend. When he walked, she walked with him, not quite at his side, but a few feet away from him. And the dog crept along with them, eyeing her with quick tilts of his head, but not biting her or even growling. He seemed to understand that the man Nathaniel did not want him to attack her. As they went up the steps and through the front door, she paused, remembering the night she'd come here, the blasting noise of the killing stick, the chomping teeth of the dog, the pain and blood of her wounds, her desperate escape out to the barn. It all started coming back to her.
It's all right, he said. You and I have made our peace and buried the hatchet.
The hatchet? She said, pretty sure that this was a kind of small, sapling-killing axe of the hand.
It's just an old expression, he said. Come on inside.
Willa stepped into the house and gazed around at the eating room and the main room beyond. Everything seemed so different from what it was when she had been crawling on the floor through the darkness.
What do you have a hankering for?
He asked. Willa knew immediately what she wanted, even before she could recall its name. She tried to remember what the Cherokee prisoner boy had called them. The word felt wrong on her lips, garbled, like it couldn't actually be a real word. But it made her mouth water just to think about it.
Cook, she said. Cookies. I have a...
She tried to remember the words he had used.
I have a hankering for cookies.
Ah, he said. I thought maybe somebody besides me and Scout had been into that jar.
The man Nathaniel started to smile. He was trying to be kind to her, welcoming, as he called it. But as soon as he said these words, he seemed to be suddenly overcome. His expression contorted and he turned away from her, rubbing his forehead with his hand.
I'm afraid my supply of cookies has run dry, he said soberly, his voice shaking with emotion.
After a few moments, he regained his composure and turned back around.
But I've got some good fresh cornbread from the latest batch from the mill, and I can cook up some venison if you want a proper meal.
What is venison? She asked.
He looked at her in surprise.
You know, meat.
When he saw the confusion in her face, he said,
Deer meat.
I sleep with deer. I don't eat them, she said.
Ah... he said hesitantly. All right. No venison, then. What do you eat?
Shoots, berries, nuts, rock tripe lichen.
He tilted his head, as if he wasn't sure if she was being serious with him.
I've tried that sort of thing, he said, but never been too partial to it. I'm afraid sticks taste like sticks, if you know what I mean. And I hate acorns in particular. My papa used to tell me you can eat 'em, but I think you'd have to be full-on starving to do it. Well, listen, let's try some of this cornbread over here and see how you like it.
What animal did you kill to make the cornbread? She asked, narrowing her eyes at him.
It's made from corn flour from the mill, he said.
The wheel in the water.
That's right.
So it's called a mill?
Yes, that's right. People bring me their corn and their wheat, and I grind it. I take one sack out of every eight in the way of payment. I figure, why plant and harvest crops, digging in the dirt for somebody else all day, when I can sit and watch a wheel go round on my own sweet time?
You weren't watching the wheel go round on the day I first saw you, she said, trying to say the word round like he did.
No, that's true, he said. Somebody did me a bad turn. Shoved a hammer in the machinery. Knocked everything all catawampus, trying to break the teeth off my main gear. Looking to put me out of business, no doubt. But I stopped it in time and got the gears lined up proper again.
Willa listened as carefully as she could, trying to understand all the confusing words he used, but she couldn't understand how the mill could have teeth.
I'm competing with half a dozen other mills down in Cade's Cove, he continued on, so I need to keep working.
Is that who damaged the mill?
No, no, those are good folk down there, he said. We're competitors, sure, but they'd never do anything underhanded like that.
He looked out the window toward the forest.
I know exactly who did it, he added bitterly. And those are the ones you gotta be careful of.
This man Nathaniel talked in a peculiar fashion, and he talked a lot. It was as if for years he had been used to talking all day long, but lately he had been alone, and all the words pent up inside him came pouring out, like water splashing down through the buckets of his wheel. As he continued, she didn't speak as much as he did, but watched him and listened to him. He fascinated her. He wasn't anything like what the Padawan had told her the day folk were. He wasn't violent or hateful. He didn't attack her or beat her or try to capture her or kill her. She'd seen other homesteaders only from a distance, small families building their log cabins, tending to their little farms, traveling on their carriages. But this man who called himself Nathaniel seemed so different from the Padawan, the Yaders, and the other Farron of the clan. Were all the day folk as evil as the Padawan described, other than this one man? Why do you cut the trees? She blurted out suddenly, looking for his evilness. He hesitated, unable to find the words to explain his actions. Why do you kill them? She pressed him.
I cut down trees to make my house, to warm my home, to make tools. There are many uses for wood. I could not live here without it. Why are you asking this question? Are the trees friends of yours?
She knew he had meant this as a joke, but she answered with the truth. Yes, they are, she said. And when you cut them, they die. He studied her for several long seconds, not saying a word.
Yes,
he admitted finally, quite softly.
The trees die, but I only cut what I need. We all have to survive.
Do you need that wall? She asked, pointing toward the wooden wall. Do you need the wooden wheel that turns in the water more than those trees needed their lives? Do you need the meat of the deer more than the deer needs her life? More than the fawn needs her mother?
I never looked at it that way, he admitted.
And then he repeated,
I just take what I need.
Like the wolf, she said.
I don't know about that, he said, bristling.
He didn't like to be compared to a wolf. She could see he had no love for wolves. He was a kind man, but a fool, too. She watched as he pulled out a sharpened blade of steel with an antler grip, cut a slice of cornbread, and handed it to her.
"Have some of this and see how you like that mill," he said, smiling a little. "You want butter on that?"
"No," she said. She didn't know what butter was or what he killed to make it. As soon as she put the bread between her lips, it began to melt in her mouth. It was unlike anything she had ever tasted before.
"You like that," he said, nodding and smiling. "You like it a lot. You see, I'm not all bad."
That first day, when she was watching him from the forest, he had seemed so sad, and then his melancholy shifted like the wind into a deep anger. And when he returned from his journey down the river earlier that afternoon, he had seemed so exhausted, not just in body, but in spirit. But now he seemed to have forgotten a little bit of what had stormed through him a short time before, and she could feel the same thing happening to her. Their words and their smiles were affecting her, changing her in little ways, like the river shaping the stone. Chapter 42. In the days that followed, it was one strange incident after another. She ate with the man Nathaniel while sitting at something he called his dinner table. She sat with him and the dog by the warm glow of the fire in the evenings. She watched him work in his mill in the afternoons, with the turn, turn, turning of the millstone grinding the wheat into flour while they talked. Sometimes they walked together in the forest, teaching each other the way they saw the world. She learned many new English words, like that he called his killing stick a rifle or a gun, and she taught him the foreign names of many of the plants and animals in the forest. When he showed her how to operate the mill, she taught him the songs of the birds flitting in the trees above their heads. "There's something that has always confused me about the English language," she admitted one afternoon as they walked in the forest.
"What is it?"
he asked. She stopped and pointed to the needles of a pine tree. "What color do you call that?"
"Green," he said.
"In the Faran language, that color is called Arunda," she said. "So, if the pine needles are what you call green, then what color is that?" She pointed to fresh grass growing in a small patch of sunlight.
"That's green, too," he said.
"But that's Finlalin," she said in confusion. "They are totally different colors."
"Light green?" He shrugged. "It's still green."
"What about that color there?" she asked, pointing to the shiny, waxy leaves of a rhododendron bush.
"Green," he said.
"No," she said in exasperation. "That's a different color. You can see the difference with your eyes, right?"
"Looks like green to me," he said. "Maybe a slightly different shade, but it's still green. How many words do you have in your language for the green colors you see in the forest?"
She shook her head. "I don't know. They're all different colors to me. But at least 40 or 50.
"I'll stick with regular old green, thank you," he said with a smile, bumping her gently with his arm.
As they continued through the forest, she couldn't help from taking a quiet, contented sigh. There was something about spending time with this unusual human that felt surprisingly like her soul was swimming in the warm water of the sacred lake of the bears. But every morning, the man, Nathaniel, grabbed his killing stick and trudged into the forest in the direction of the river with his dog Scout at his side. He did not tell her where he was going or what he was doing, and it was clear that he didn't want to talk about it. Curious to know what he was doing, she slipped through the undergrowth and watched him from a distance. He followed the bank of the river downstream, close along the jagged, moss-covered rocks, many of them towering over his head, others low and tumbled, with the water flowing between them. The dog ran up and down along the bank, his nose to the ground, looking for scent, working with the man Nathaniel, seeming to understand what he was looking for and as anxious to find it as he was. The man and the dog came to a shallow section of the river where it was clear the man wanted to cross, but the water was running strong even here. To her amazement, the man slung his rifle by its leather strap over his back, picked his dog up in his arms, and began to wade across. He plowed slowly through the current with forceful, deliberate steps as the water crashed against his thighs. "Be careful," Willa whispered as she watched from the trees, the palms of her hands sweating. She could imagine the powerful current pulling the man Nathaniel off his feet and sweeping him and the frantically swimming dog down into the rocky rapids below. When they finally reached the other side, the dog leapt from his arms and shook himself dry, and then the two of them continued on their way, receding into the distance farther downstream on the opposite bank of the river. She thought the man and his dog must be going out to hunt for their food, and that he wasn't talking about it because he knew it would bother her. But when they returned later that afternoon, the man wasn't just empty-handed, but solemn and exhausted, like he'd gone to the ends of the earth. His boots and trousers were soaked, his hands roughened by the abrasion of stone, and his clothes were torn. Willa's brows furrowed in confusion. Where was he going every day? What was he doing out there? She watched from her spot in the top of the sourwood tree as they came up from the river. The dog ran into the house, his tail wagging, excited to be home. Maybe looking for her, she thought. But the man Nathaniel didn't go in. He walked in silence to the meadow near the house, where the rays of the setting sun were shining down. He stood there alone, unmoving and unchanging for a long time, except for the glisten of light trickling down his cheeks. As she watched him, she felt as if the world was being held still, held in that moment, as if she couldn't breathe, couldn't move, her heart slowing to a low, steady, thumping beat, as if in that moment she could reach out across the distance between them and without any knowledge or understanding or words, know what the man Nathaniel was feeling. Later that evening, with the feeling of that moment still in her heart, she went down to the river and sat by herself, listening to the water flowing between the stones and remembering the sound of her grandmother's barren voice. She remembered the look in her grandmother's eyes and the warmth of her touch, the way her mamma had wrapped her in her arms, as if she were encasing her in a cocoon that would protect her forever. And Willa remembered playing games of hide-and-seek with her sister, Aliu, in the dappled shade of the wooded dells, the two of them blending from one place to another as they took turns hiding from one another. She remembered the smile that lit up Aliu's little spotted face whenever Willa found her. They played through the sunlit days and the moonlit nights, running and blending and searching and laughing, over and over again. Sitting there by the river on her own, she could see it all in her mind, and she could hear the soft sound of Aliu's voice as they explored the forest together with their mamma and their parents. She remembered Aliu talking to a nest of frightened sparrows that had fallen from a tree, the way she cupped the little birds in her hands and reassured them that she would put them back where they belonged. Willa remembered it all, but as the sound of the barren words drifted from her memory, it was like the whispers of the water flowing down the tumbling river. And as the moon rose from the darkened peak of the great mountain looming in the distance, the man Nathaniel came down to the river and sat beside her in the quiet and seemed to understand not just her sense of silence, but her sense of loss. He seemed to know, as if from his own experience, that there were parts of her life that he could not understand, words from her past that she longed to hear, but he could not speak. Chapter 43. The next day, while the man Nathaniel was away down the river, Willow remained in the forest near the house. Every day, wherever she was and whatever she was doing, she had been practicing her woodland skills. Her mamma had taught her the long history of her sky-reaching friends and the other plants, and all the ancient words and whispers she needed to converse with them. But now that she had begun to learn more and more on her own, she realized there was so much more she wanted to understand and do. She practiced lying on the ground in a patch of ferns and vines, and then asking the plants to grow across her body until she disappeared, not just by blending the color and texture of her skin, but by physically covering the entirety of her body with the growth of the plants. She was able to achieve the growth she wanted, but it turned out to be surprisingly difficult to actually get out of the ferns and vines once they'd grown over her. The plants seemed to like holding on to her, with their tiny, sticky stems and their curling tendrils adhering to her skin. As she was climbing out of the vines, she noticed a small slug slithering over a nearby rock. That was one of the few creatures of the forest she didn't like, but this time it repulsed her even more than usual. The slug's mucus-coated skin reminded her of the Patteran when he caught his foot in the jaws of the trap. She still couldn't figure out exactly what she had seen when she glanced back to look at him, but the image had stuck in her memory. The Patteran had always had deep bronze skin that seemed to be filled with light, but for that single moment when he was in terrible pain and distress, his skin had turned as gray and slimy as a slug. Back when she was a Yater stealing for the clan, she thought the Patteran was a great leader, feared and respected by all, the wise father to her struggling people. But now that she had left the lair, she wondered why he had hated the old ways so deeply, why he had been trying so desperately to wipe out the last remnants of the wood witches and their forest powers. What harm had they been doing? She hated the dark memories of her old life. She didn't want to think about the Dead Hollow lair or the Patteran. But questions kept sneaking into her mind like little worms. Where did he come from? Who was he? She had heard stories that the Patteran wasn't a normal Farron like the other members of the clan, that he had come down from the top of the great mountain to lead the Farron people. And it had been easy to believe. But what confused her now was that she had actually climbed the great mountain, felt its presence in her heart, and heard its voice in her soul. She remembered vast clouds of mist, and a soaring hawk, and trees, and mountains for as far as the eye could see. But she didn't see any sign that the Patteran, or anyone like him, had ever been there. Near the end of the day, when she heard the man Nathaniel coming her way, she relaxed her blend so that he could see her. As he walked up to her, a vine was growing along her arm and around her wrist like a dayfolk bracelet, and another was twining up into her hair. The man watched the movement of the vines in silence, astonished and transfixed by what he was seeing.
"How do you do it?" he asked softly.
Willa tried to think of a way to explain it in English words, but it was difficult. "With my mind, and sometimes my voice, I ask the vines to move."
"Have you always been able to do this?"
"My mamma has been teaching me all my life, and I've been practicing more and more.
What do you call what you do?
In the Faran language, it used to be called Esperia. In English, we call it woodcraft.
Woodcraft,
he repeated slowly, as if he was trying to absorb both the sound of it and the meaning of what he was seeing. Years ago, many of my people had the knowledge and the power of woodcraft. It still runs very strong in the members of a few families. My mother and father and my sister all had the power, and my grandmother was the one who taught me. But I think I might be the last of the Whisperers now.
The Whisperers?
The man Nathaniel said in gentle surprise. I like the sound of that.
And you and your people call yourselves Faran? Is that right?
Willa smiled and nodded. And you and your people call yourself human, is that right? The man Nathaniel smiled.
Yes, at least once I've had my breakfast in the morning.
She liked the way he smiled when he said these words, and she liked the way it made her feel.
Listen, I came over to ask you. I need to go check on something, and I thought you might want to come along with me. I think I could use your help.
Willa rose to her feet, pleased to be included. A while later, as she walked along with the man Nathaniel and the dog Scout through the forest, she asked, "Where are we going?"
"We left the edge of my property behind us," he said, making his way through the undergrowth of the trees. "But I saw something back here in the woods that's been festering in my mind."
"What do you mean, your property?" she asked.
"My land," he said. "The property I own."
She still didn't understand. As they walked along, Scout stayed close at her side. He had become used to her, and her to him. She liked the way he was always looking ahead, always scanning with his eyes and nose and ears. She thought there must be a little bit of wolf in him. When she reached down to pet his head, he looked up at her, and she was surprised to see the worry in his eyes. He was smelling something ahead of them that he didn't like one bit. She turned to Nathaniel and saw he was anxious as well. They soon came to a footpath, and Nathaniel stopped.
"Can you sense anything?" he asked her. "Do you see anything unusual?"
Understanding that he wanted her to put her woodland skills to work, she crouched to the ground and looked at the earth, the lichen, and leaves. She noticed the way some of the ferns were bent and a few of the leaves were pressed down. "Humans have been walking here," she said, "all of them wearing heavy boots, one of them dragging some kind of tool or object behind him."
"How many men?" he asked.
"At least four," she said, looking around at the footprints. Fear clouded Nathaniel's face.
"Can you tell how long ago?"
Checking the amount of wear and dryness on the edge of the footprints, and thinking about the last time it had rained, she said, "Yesterday."
"That's not good," he said, shaking his head. "Let's follow the tracks a little ways and see what we can learn."
As they walked on, they both noticed long red strips of cloth that had been tied onto some of the larger oak trees. "What are they?" she asked.
"They're marking the most important trees to cut," he said, his voice filled with fear and anger all at once.
"I don't understand," she said. The thought of cutting down these beautiful trees made her eyes water, and she could feel the heat rising up into her face.
"These men are scouts for the logging company, surveying the forest to determine which groves to cut first, and finding the best route for their railroad to come up into the mountains. They've got a new kind of engine that puts power to all its wheels so it can handle hauling full loads of logs down the mountain slopes. But even the new engines have limits, so they have to map out their path.
So they're coming up here now, she said, her voice cracking in dismay.
Right now, what they most want is my land, he said. I own a section along the river.